From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. You all know Robin Sachs as a former assistant district attorney in Los Angeles County. She's a practicing attorney now, author, victims advocate, and someone who's been covering the Conrad Murray trial. The defense has rested. And Robin, how are you this evening?
I'm doing okay, thank you. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. The rumors are out on the internet, on your Twitter, that you dressed up like a bottle of propofol for Halloween. Is that true?
You know what? It's the only truth to the rumor is that the rumors must be in my is in everybody's got inside my brain, because I was trying to figure out the ultimate Conrad Murray type of costume, and I couldn't figure out how to do propofol. I couldn't figure out how to do Conrad Murray that wouldn't appear rude. And so I dress up my big mouth.
Oh, good grief. Anyway, Robin's webpage, robinsachs.com. Check it out. Her Twitter, at Robin Sachs. All right, the defense is rested. Conrad Murray has not testified. Last time we had you on, we talked prosecution. Let's talk defense.
Well, let's first talk about how that no one is resting from the legal team tonight. While the case is resting, the both sides are very busy working on their closing arguments and wrapping this case ready to go in front of the jury, but I'm now ready to answer the question you actually asked. Actually, I think I was just pulling a little bit of Dr. White. I was answering the question I wanted to answer instead of the question you asked me, which is exactly what Dr. White did in this case when he was on cross-examination with David Walgren, and it blew up in his face in an unbelievable way.
You know, what are your thoughts on, and I'm trying to paraphrase this the right way, Conrad Murray not testifying? Of course, it's all over the media that the defense lawyers are arguing about whether or not to put him on the stand, and they decided not to. Looking at your Twitter, you said that was a wise move. I agree with you.
Listen, I said from the beginning the dumbest thing that they could possibly do is to put Dr. Murray on the stand. He testified in this case. He testified in 2009, and he has the benefit of doing it with his counsel there, without the prosecution there, and without being cross-examined. They dictated the interview. They did it at the fancy hotel that he was staying at, and he got his story out. So there was no upside, or there would be no upside. The only issue was whether or not Conrad Murray, who has the personal choice, the personal decision, regardless of what his lawyers may advise or think, to be able to have the opportunity to testify or not. That's the ultimate right of our Constitution and our country here, to be able to remain silent or to not. And you know, what I'm hoping or what I'm gathering is that even though there's been a lot of discord amongst the defense team, I would imagine that they both agree that he should not testify, and if he wants to tell a story, the best place to tell a story is in an interview with you, with me, with someone who is not going to be presenting a case and closing arguments to a jury.
Robin Sachs is here. Of course, she's covering the Conrad Murray trial for ET Online, and again at her webpage, robinsachs.com. Let's rate the defense team out of 10, if that's possible. Some good days, some bad days, or am I wrong?
Listen, I think the defense had a very difficult case from day one. I mean, this is not, I really hate giving grades. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to give not a very high grade to the defense, especially, you know, when you look at lawyers, you can't help but look at them side by side. You know, it's the same thing that you do, you know, if you do a taste testing of apple pies or beers and wines. You taste them next to each other and you can compare one to the next. So by comparison to this case, they got killed by the the DAs. I mean, their case was much less organized. It was not focused. But the biggest flaw that I think that they made was they really were wedded and married to the idea that this was going to be a self-administration theory. And I think that with the limitations in the rulings that were the some of the defense with their arms tied behind them and the self-administration, they created a burden for themselves when they didn't even have a burden of proof. And I think that that is not the best lawyering that I've ever seen.
Robin Sachs is here. The closing arguments, when do you think this will go to the jury?
If they're smart, and that's, you know, everything's got that caveat, is that both the DA and the defense will realize, listen, they want to get out of there, and any delays perceived by one side or the other, one side dragging on too long, will be something that they will could potentially pay for in deliberation a little bit, maybe not a lot, but a little bit. But at the same time, they will weigh this to make sure that they get their whole story in case. So my guess is you're looking at about an hour of jury instructions. You know, I think that both sides should be able to argue the case, to be done with the case Thursday, if not Friday morning. At the latest, the case should be to the jury on Friday. And I, you know, it's before weekend, so you always have that. Are they going to decide for the weekend? I don't know that this is something that's going to be, even if it's, whether it's an acquittal or a conviction, it's going to take some time. The case has been there. There's got to be some homage paid by the jurors, amount of time to at least deliberate.
Let's talk a little bit about assuming there is a conviction. Acquittal is, of course, we know, but let's look at the parameters of sentencing when it comes to a conviction. A lot of people don't understand. They think that Conrad Murray has the possibility of going away to jail for a very long time. That's not true.
Well, the first misconception that everyone should be aware of is that there will not be a perp walk on at the end of this trial, whether he's convicted or not. This isn't the kind of thing that they're going to put the clink and put the cuffs on him and take him in the back, even if he's convicted. So all you camera folks are waiting for your Lindsay Lohan photo op. You might as well put the cameras away. It's not happening. There will be sentencing that will be put over to anywhere between 20 days, 30 days, 40, 50, 60, 90 days for both sides to prepare to discuss sentencing and appeal and all those kinds of things. Then, at that point, the issue will be sentencing. Now, no doubt, if there is a conviction, there will be an argument for time in this case by Judge Murray, but even still, and that's going to be then the next fight along the way, the case for him, for Dr. Murray's point of view, from his camp, any punishment that involves his medical license is not... is a major loss unless he's already packed his bags and going back to Trinidad, which maybe he will be. But in terms of practicing medicine, I mean, this is a guy with a lot of financial obligations, kids under every rock. He's got his finances cut ahead of him, and his career depends on the outcome of this case. If it's, you know, that's number one. Now, granted, once if he's going to jail, I guess he doesn't care so much about his career. But this is not a case that I can imagine that even the DA's office is looking for any lengthy state prison time. My guess is it does look for some time. And he's, you know, the ideal candidate for house arrest or probation or any of those things. He has no record, no conviction. Although I think that's where it'll be very hairy, because I guarantee you the Jackson family will be very vocal that, you know, he is a murderer and this was a conspiracy and he should go away for the maximum. So we'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. Robin Sachs is here. Speaking of going to jail, the Lohan family, the biggest train wreck since I don't know what. Let's talk about them a little bit. Lindsay going to go for breaching her probation?
Well, listen, she's already, the word on the street is that she's going to admit her violation of probation, which I actually think is a very smart thing to do. No doubt Sean Chapman, Holly putting on her thinking cap again on that one, because really, the big issue was going to happen was the punishment could have been far worse than what the punishment will be tomorrow if it came out that she was trying to manipulate probation officers and manipulate psychiatrists and manipulate people writing reports for her. I think that in light of the grand scheme of things and in light of the cooling off period that Judge Sautner had and in light of the fact that she said and already said that there is no teeth in the jail system, she, you know, I don't know that she's not. I don't believe she will do nothing, but I can see her doing some sort of an exorbitant amount of time at the place that she's been so wildly successful at, and that's the LA County Morgue. I can see her actually saying, listen, you've been doing such a good job there. You've shown up. It's gruesome work. They're not going to let you off the hook easy. I think we're going to give you another 30 days of morgue duty.
Yeah.
And that would not surprise me if we saw that tomorrow. The only thing that if we did see that tomorrow that we should keep in mind is that that morgue duty is almost a setup for failure for Lindsay if she doesn't get her act together.
Yep.
Because 30 days of 8-hour shifts in a short period of time is just enough rope for her to hang herself. And that's what, you know, everybody's believed for the moment. So we'll see.
Speaking of the nut not falling far from the tree, her dad is... Well, what can you say? He's as goofy as they come. Let's talk a little bit about Michael Lohan.
Oh, God. Well, you know, actually, I have to say, for timing purposes, Michael Lohan's double brush with domestic violence last week probably became a point of sympathy and a huge opportunity for the judge to be able to get a bird's-eye view into the household in which Lindsay Lohan grew up. I mean, this is a grown man who was ordered by a court to not even dream about Kate Majors, and the next thing you know, he's jumping out of windows into trees as he's violating the orders that already started with him trying to convince her not to testify. So one can't sit here and guess how is it that she doesn't take these things seriously when that's the role model, on top of being a child star, on top of the criticism, on top of everything else.
Absolutely. Robin Sachs is here on Twitter, at Robin Sachs. One last thought on Rebecca, and I can never pronounce the last name, Zahu. Fascinating case. We're all following it. Your thoughts on that?
Listen, first of all, there's some great people behind that case. Ann Bremner's representing the Zahu family.
Yep.
And as Estelle West is doing the, has done the new autopsy. The one thing about that case that is really troubling for me is the fact that no matter what, the fact that the case was ruled as a suicide to begin with is going, it almost already makes built-in reasonable doubt. It's the first question of, if they end up arresting the husband or any other potential suspect or person, the first thing you're going to say is, okay, you ruled the case as suicide, you changed your mind, how can we believe anything you said? There's problems with this case yet to come, but at least everybody knows it, sees it, that it smells bad, and hopefully at least there's closure for the family, because it's clearly, you and I both know, not a suicide.
Absolutely, that's for sure. Robin Sachs, robinsachs.com. Thank you. Have a good night, ma'am.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's a former ADA out of Los Angeles County, Robin Sachs, who's covering the Conrad Murray trial for ET Online and My Fox LA. And, of course, go to, robinsachs.com or at Robin Sachs on Twitter for more coverage. In fact, we fired up Twitter. Everybody's been asking me about getting on Twitter, and, well, we fired it up for the show. So if you do, at Dana Pretzer, at DanaPretzer, or Pretzer, if you live in the United States or Canada. So at Dana Pretzer on Twitter, you'll find some interesting things about the Scared Monkeys radio network, some behind-the-scenes things, some tips on guests, and lots of discussions. So if I see you're interested and we get lots of people going on there, we'll have more information on Twitter for sure. And that's at Dana Pretzer. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back. We've got Wendy Murphy. You all know Wendy Murphy. Last time we had Wendy on, we were talking about Casey Anthony, and it was a heated show, to say the least, when Wendy predicted that Casey Anthony would be acquitted, and there were lots of angry people about Wendy, but Wendy was right. Now, we won't get into that tonight, but we are going to talk about the Lisa Irwin case and Wendy's most recent article at the Patriot Ledger. Although Wendy is in New England, where the big storms are happening, so we hope that we can get Wendy. So I'm going to take a break, and we'll try and get Wendy on the phone and talk to her about the Lisa Irwin case. And then a little bit later on tonight, Fred Rosen, author Fred Rosen, will be here to talk about his new death, Trails of Death. Fantastic new book that he has. Fascinating. If you go to his webpage at fredrosen.com, you'll learn more about that. So this is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio, on Twitter at Dana Pretzer. You can listen to us live at scaredmonkeysradio.com, podcasts of past shows, you name it. We're here for you all the time. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. Hey, we're back. We all know Wendy Murphy is a former sex crimes prosecutor, author, law professor, and always a big kick to have her on the show. Hi, Wendy.
Hey, Dana. Good to be with you again.
And I was worried about you. I didn't know if you'd be all snowed in down there or not. Like we said off air, that's crazy weather I should be having, not you.
And you can have it.
Yeah.
No, we're drying up. Oh, well, it's not drying up. We're melting. We're already melting.
We're going to talk a little bit about your article about Lisa Irwin for the Patriot Ledger, but I want to get your thoughts first. The Conrad Murray trial, it's going to go to the jury here after closing arguments. Where do you think that's going to go?
Well, I think a fairer question is probably how fast will they come back with a guilty verdict,
yeah.
Because it really is, sometimes that's really the issue too for lawyers. It's not, they expect to lose, and it's a victory if you keep the jury out for, you know, a day or two as opposed to an hour. I don't really understand where the controversy lies that could even give the defense an argument about reasonable doubt. I understand what they're going to say, that Michael Jackson may have done this to himself. The problem with that is the jury's going to be instructed. And I do think this is going to be the critical question, the causation issue. The jury's going to be instructed that Conrad Murray's behavior would have to have caused his death. And the jury's, and so, you know, to the extent the defense says, well, Michael Jackson gave himself propofol, even if the jury believed that or wondered if that could be true, which I think is highly doubtful,
yeah.
They're also going to be told that Conrad Murray's behavior needn't be the only potential cause of death. So that even if they think Michael Jackson contributed in some way to his death by his behavior or his use of drugs or his taking, you know, some of the benzodiazepines that he was getting from other doctors, you cannot generate a not guilty verdict because the victim did things that also may have contributed to their death. And you know, the law school teaches us this stuff about causation all the and it's a very, you know, simple concept. If two people both shoot a bullet at one victim and the victim dies, they can both be held accountable and found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, even though it's true as a matter of fact that only one of them caused the death. So I think that's the easiest way to explain the concept. It doesn't matter what Michael Jackson did to himself, because what Conrad Murray did, beyond all doubt, also, or separately, or, you know, alone, caused his death. And it was clearly gross negligence. They're not even disputing gross negligence. The idea of this guy landing with an acquittal is absurd. I think the closing arguments won't even be that interesting, frankly. And I think that's why not a lot of people are paying attention. It's deadly dull to watch a case unfold where there's no mystery.
You know, some of the comedians out there have said, who needs propofol? All you have to do is watch a trial like that, and it puts you to sleep right away. And I'm not making fun of the death of Michael Jackson, but I thought that was comical to hear that. But let's talk just a little bit about the jury system itself. All we have to do is go back to Casey Anthony and the uproar after that fiasco. And I will go on record to say very early on in that trial, you predicted on my show that she would be acquitted.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the jury system now. How much pressure will that be on this jury to get it right?
I don't know that these cases are similar enough for the jury to even wonder about that case.
Okay.
You know, the only thing that really is in common between them is that they're both in sort of high profile cases.
Right.
They otherwise don't raise similar questions about the role of the jury. I don't know. I mean, I do think that when there's a huge disaster, an injustice like the O.J. Simpson acquittal, that really does throw the system into turmoil because it's so irrational, and I think then human beings in the form of jurors start to feel that they have a responsibility because they do bring a bit of democracy to the process, and I think they start to feel a responsibility to do repair work, and there was some of that after the O.J. Simpson acquittal. I don't think that theme is in the air. And even though people felt very angry about the Casey Anthony acquittal, It's not anger in the same way. I think it was more an emotional reaction to the fact that a child was dead and a mother had been so cavalier about her disappearance. That emotion is reasonable. You know, that outrage about her behavior is reasonable. But I don't think it's as directly connected to the failure of the system, simply because, you know, if you read the evidence objectively, there was absolutely no proof that she killed her child. There was good proof she was, you know, not a great mother and all sorts of other reasons to dislike her, but there was absolutely no evidence she killed her child. There was a lot of evidence she wasn't even with her child when she died, and she didn't have her car at certain points on the days in question. And, you know, so if you just think objectively about that case, you wouldn't be angry about the system so much as the fact that a little girl could have had a mother like that.
Another missing child, another mother in the spotlight, high-profile attorney Joe Tacopina. I've interviewed him before. He loves the cameras, but now he's not doing so much of that in this case. Let's talk about Lisa Irwin and your article for the Patriot Ledger.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, and Joe, I've known Joe for a long time. He has a lot of experience with high-profile cases, which is why, and he also is expensive.
Yeah.
And well-deserved, I'm sure, which is why when he became involved in the case, my view of the case was instantly affected. I think of this Lisa Irwin story as, in terms of the strategy we're watching play out on the news, as taking a page straight out of the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Right.
Why do I say that? Well, number one, right out of the box, you've got a hired gun lawyer who the family is putting onto television. Putting onto television. Mm-hmm. Or the lawyer's putting the family on television. And you remember with the Ramseys, it was, I think, New Year's Day or the day after New Year's, they're on CNN making statements even though they weren't talking to police. That's not right.
No.
That's already wrong. That's already what the hell is going on here kind of, you know, vibe for me. And the parents are stuck together like glue. Same thing happened in the Ramsey case, that they declined separate interviews with police. Who does that? When your kid is missing and the police want to talk to you separately, you don't say, no, thank you, we're gonna only be interviewed together, and oh, by the way, we've stopped cooperating completely. That's such a Ramsey-esque move right out of the box. And, you know, there's all kinds of money in the background. Remember, the Ramseys hired a PR team, and then that was manipulating public opinion, and now we know there's, you know, some secret amount of money. Some anonymous donor is tossing money around behind the scenes for an investigator for the family, and obviously that's how Joe's getting paid. So we should be super suspicious. Now, here's the thing, and I write about this in my book, in a chapter I call the cross-finger-pointing problem. The reason parents together like glue when they are suspects, when they are have something to hide, is because so long as neither of them talks, the cops can never figure out exactly which one is guilty. And then if they decide to proceed against one or the other of the parents, they each can point the finger at the other one, and they both have built in reasonable doubt. It's a very sneaky little trick. Defense attorneys who are real slick know how to make it happen from the get-go. And you start to see the strategy build right out of the box, which is what I think we're seeing here. And by the way, I know this is going to sound a little funny, but as soon as I saw it was Lisa's mother, Deb Bradley, on the television talking about the bad things she had done, oh, I lied. It wasn't 10:30 when I put the child to bed. It was 6:30.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, I was drunk out of my mind.
Yeah.
All that she did was give the public a reason to feel rage toward her and suspicion toward her. And she did that after she had a defense attorney on board and after she stopped talking to cops. So we should be asking ourselves, why would a person who's represented by a very sophisticated attorney want to go on television and make herself look like a liar and a drunk while she's supposed to be caring for her child? Because that's just going to make her look guilty, right? Who does that? Why would a person do that? It's irrational. If you're a criminal defense, if you're a suspect in a criminal case and you want to take the fifth, that's fine. But you wouldn't go on television and make yourself look more guilty, especially in this rather seemingly planned way where she was out there dumping two particular facts into the court of public opinion. She lied about what time she put the child down, and she was drunk out of her mind. Okay, that gives her a nice excuse if she then says, I don't remember anything. So I don't even believe she was drunk. I believe she put that out there so that she would then have an excuse when she has to then explain herself why she doesn't recall what happened. But besides that, it makes us all focus on her. Notice her husband, well, her boyfriend, the father of little Lisa, you notice how he was entirely quiet.
Right.
As soon as I saw her out there on the hot seat making statements that made her look bad, and he was rock solid silent, again, I go back to the Ramsey case. That's exactly what happened with John and Patsy. John didn't say anything. John didn't say anything. Makes me suspicious of the child's father. It makes me suspicious of the child's father, because why is he saying nothing and the mother is condemning herself? What that does from a tactical perspective is it gives the public, it gives the public reason to be suspicious about the mother. But if the cops are actually suspicious of the father, let's assume for a minute cops are actually suspicious of the father, which may be true, maybe not. If they're suspicious of him, then the best thing from his perspective in terms of his defense strategy, and the best thing from both of their perspectives if they're trying to thwart justice altogether, is to build up a case of suspicion against the mother. The more suspicion is laid on the mother, the more trouble the cops are going to have bringing charges against him, because they're going to, and prosecutors are going to be thinking to themselves, we can't bring charges against the father because there's so much smoke and suspicion around the mother. That's reasonable doubt. We can't bring charges against the father. That's what could be going on here. And it makes me crazy, because if this is all nonsense and smoke and mirrors, the police and prosecutors can't fix the problem. Right. They can't go on networks and say, we'd like to tell you what the evidence is.
Exactly.
We'd like to tell you who we're really suspicious of. We'd like to explain to you why we think the mother is lying, or not lying, or pretending to lie, or pretending to be drunk. We'd like to tell you what we found when we executed the search warrant and, you know, took x-rays of you know, sealed boxes in the home. And we'd like to tell you what it is that we are suspicious about that's on those three cell phones that are missing. We'd like to tell you why we think parents of a missing child with cell phones would be worried about us knowing what's on those cell phones. But we can't. Why? Because if we tell the truth to the public, the judge in the case could say, unfair pretrial publicity, prejudicial to the defendant, motion to suppress the evidence, dismiss the charges. The prosecutors and the cops get in trouble when they tell the truth about the evidence. The defense gets in no trouble at all, even when they lie. And this sort of twisted, very unbalanced reality about what happens in the court of public opinion when real-world stuff is being investigated is not well understood by the public. The public doesn't really understand that they're being played sometimes in these cases, and that what they're watching is a strategy unfold. And it's not an unveiling of the truth. It's an unveiling of a tactic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Joel Brodsky told me that on the show when he said he was going to represent Drew Peterson. He said, I'm going to use the media as much as I can. And it's just, I don't know, it's a double standard that, you know, one side can, one side can't. But let's talk about criticizing the cops in this case and others. It's always the focus on the cops being too tough on the parents, all that sort of thing. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, and this, again, the same thing happened in the Ramsey case.
Yep.
Oh, they're so harsh on us. We can't possibly do an interview. We're so distraught. And the same thing in this case. Oh, you know, the cops were a little too tough on us, and so we just decided to stop cooperating. First of all, and I think this goes without saying, and it's not that complicated, if your kid is missing and you're innocent, there's no such thing as too tough.
Exactly.
You'll cut your fingers off. You'll cut your ears off. You'll do anything to get that child back. There is no such thing as too tough. You're not worried about the cops being too tough on you. You're worried about them not being tough enough. There is nothing cops can do to cause you distress, because your distress about your missing child is at the top of the list. That's the problem with their reaction. That's the problem with any parent saying the cops were too tough. And I think we all can understand that. Beyond that, look, the cops probably were not tough on her beyond a typical investigation. But if they got information that led them to believe they had even more concerns, And they asked them to come back so they could clarify them and ask them for access to the boys so that they could talk to them about what they saw, the, you know, 8-year-old and 5-year-old in the home. And the parents then decide, no, because we don't like your style. There's only one thing that the public and the police and prosecutors are going to assume from that answer, and it's that they're guilty. You cannot argue in court that a suspect's refusal to cooperate is evidence of guilt, but I guarantee you, every single cop on the case, every prosecutor looking at the case, when they hear that the family stops cooperating, they know they have their man, and that and they know that. They absolutely know that. That's why they're not even going to be able to get away with things like, let's go looking for her, let's get a search team. No, the public isn't dumb enough in this case, thankfully, to go searching for this child, because they know, based primarily on the family's wild refusal and irrational refusal to cooperate and even let them talk to the boys, that means that, you know, that they're involved. The boys, I'm particularly concerned about, because at those ages, 8 and 5, if they know anything, number one, they're going to be easily tricked into not telling the truth. The same thing happened to some extent with Burke Ramsey.
Right.
Whatever he knew, he wasn't allowed to be interviewed early on either. You can manipulate kids and downright scare them into not telling the truth about what they know if you keep them away from cops long enough. So I had originally written in my piece that I hope they convene a grand jury fast and send subpoenas for the kids, because the kids aren't going to assert their Fifth Amendment rights. They don't have any. The parents can't forbid them to testify. Parents have no authority to trump a subpoena to testify before a grand jury. If the kid is called to testify, it's got to happen. And if they don't cooperate, social services has authority to go in and remove the child from the home and force the kid to participate. The problem is, if they don't do it quickly, I think the kids can be manipulated into saying things that aren't necessarily true. And by the way, that's child abuse.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's no evidence of child neglect at this point, although I'd take them from the home anyway. But, you know, child abuse and child neglect are, it doesn't have to rise to the level of a crime to take a child out of a home. If they believe that those kids are at risk because of whatever it is that is somehow connected to Lisa's disappearance, then the kids should be taken out of the home, period, whether or not they have any evidence or knowledge about what happened. And so I'm very worried about those boys. I don't know how this case is going to end, but I do know that the beginning leads me to believe that whatever the interests are, they're a lot more powerful than a couple of parents, because they don't have money for a big fancy lawyer.
Yep.
And the public, I think, is rightly asking questions. Who has so much concern for these parents that they're paying Joe Tacopina to show up? Who would do that? Who cares that much about these people? I think, you know, there's questions about drugs and this guy Jersey, and I don't know enough about the details of the case, but this would not, you know, there are lots of cases of little kids who get sold or traded for big drug debts. It happens all the time when parents can't pay up on their drug debts, and that may not be the story here, but when kids go missing, sometimes that's the answer.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the answer here, but if there's drugs involved, you know, it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
And we have to, I think, stop looking at parents and just thinking because the kid is cute and the mother's crying and they have a lovely little home that somehow that means there aren't dastardly things going on behind closed doors.
Yep, that's so true. Wendy, always a pleasure. Thank you, ma'am.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Talk to you. Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy, her article for the Patriot Ledger about Lisa Irwin. Wendy's never shy to voice her opinion on what she thinks is going on. So we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a few minutes with Fred Rosen, author Fred Rosen, talking about his new book. And his new book is a dandy. It's called Trails of Death, and focuses on the fact that serial killer Gary Hilton once had access to nuclear weapons. So we're going to bring Fred on to talk about that and other things. Check out his webpage at fredrosen.com, and check us out at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com, and now on Twitter at Dana Pretzer. So we'll take a break, and we'll be right back here on the Dana Pretzer Show. We're back. It's been a while since I've had this guy on. He's a popular guest here on the program. He's a crime author, Fred Rosen. His new book, Trails of Death, recently featured on Inside Edition, is now available. We're going to talk about Gary Hilton, and did he have access to nuclear weapons? That's crazy. Fred, I understand that you are working with Michael Lohan on a new reality show. Is that true?
No, but I didn't realize that I was so popular, Dana.
Oh, you're popular.
Me working with Michael Lohan?
I don't know.
You know what? Wait a second, Dana. Hold everything. We're on radio, right?
We are on radio, sir.
Yes. Couldn't you at least say that I was on with Lindsay Lohan?
Yeah.
Wait. Could I be working on a reality show with Scarlett Johansson?
That'd be better. Yeah.
Hey, listen. We haven't talked in a while.
Yep.
And I just want to, I just want to inform all of the listeners that you are a police officer in Saskatchewan.
That is true.
And you obviously have the only radio show in Saskatchewan, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, thank you.
And if I remember correctly, and I haven't looked it up, but I believe the film Saskatchewan stars Tyrone Power.
That's right.
Okay. So how the heck are you?
I'm fine.
How is Canada?
Yeah.
And why is it that we can't get two candidates for President of the United States where we'd have a choice?
Yeah.
Regardless of party. Or is it the same in Canada?
It is the same. And when you look at your country compared to mine, and we're supposed to be your brother, your cousin, your whatever, just separated by a border. And you look at the politicians that are out there right now, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or in between. My kid, Fred, is going to broadcasting school right now in Washington State. I thought so much of the state that I'd send him down there because there's more opportunity in the United States for him to get into that kind of business than there is up here.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm hearing some feedback. Is that your hearing aid or mine?
Mine. Hang on for a second.
Okay.
That was the National Security Agency.
Yeah. Their bug is...
They're bugging us. Even when I'm cooking a baked potato.
Okay. Anyway, I sent my kid to the States because there's more opportunity. Now, and you're going to laugh at that, but when you are in your country, people want to leave there to come up here. So I don't know why we're just not one big country and we look after ourselves and never mind the goofy politicians.
You know what? You're making a heck of a lot of sense. And the other day, and this has nothing to do with true crime, but I was reading about how there was going to be a meeting, I think it already took place, with all the Commonwealth countries.
Right.
And they decided that you guys were going to change the, you got to explain this to me, but I guess Parliament's got to change it in England, and then you guys sort of like write off on it that in terms of the line of succession to the throne.
Yeah, pretty much. Yep.
You know, I was reading this, and I know this has nothing to do with true crime, but I found it fascinating because here we are in the 21st century, and we're finally going to say that a woman can inherit the throne if she's first or even second in line.
I thought Hillary already did that.
Yeah. You know, what's going on here? You know, who are these people?
Listen.
Are you guys in Canada going through the same stuff we're going through in the States in terms of all these idiot politicians spending tax money?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, before we get to the book, I'll share one thing with you.
Yeah.
the Canadian government hiring a consultant and paying that consultant $90,000 a day to try and figure out how the Canadian government can save money. True story.
Are you serious?
I am serious. So, you know.
You know, what's going on, Dana?
I don't know.
What are we missing here? I mean, we're all on the same, we're all in the same boat.
I think so.
We're starting on the same continent.
Yep.
Where is our money going?
I don't know. It's going
right. It's just, you know, it's you know, Dana, it's the first time I've ever really asked this question because I can't figure out where it's going.
Yeah, it's going down the drain, my friend.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
It's going down the drain. But one thing for sure, it was good that Gary Hilton never had his finger on the trigger for a nuclear weapon. Or did he?
Well, this is the funny thing. Gary, the book is called Trails of Death. It's published by Titletown Publishing. You can get it at barnesandnoble.com or amazon.com or just going to your local bookstore. This is the funny thing for me anyway. In 20-some-odd books where I've written about true crime, I have never, ever, ever come across a bad guy who, well, in this case, he would become a serial killer.
Right.
In the 1960s, Dana, the United States government, in all of its wisdom, assigned this guy, he was an enlistee, and he was in the Davy Crockett Platoon, which was a platoon that deployed nuclear weapons across Europe during the 60s.
Right.
And these were handheld nuclear weapons. I looked it up. This is all public knowledge. But what got me more than anything else was this. Now, again, this is the problem with our governments. This dude, by the time he goes in the service, he's like, 20, let's say.
Right.
He's already shot his stepfather. He shot him, Dana. He didn't kill him, but he shot him. And our government puts him into a situation where he is in this platoon deploying handheld nuclear weapons across Europe for 3 years during the Cold War. And the idea is if the East Germans come over the horizon, fire the weapon. Okay, but here's the thing. Now, you may disagree with me on this one, but only the United States could come up with a nuclear weapon where if you deploy it, the guys that are deploying it die because they're using a mortar. It's handheld.
Sure.
It's only got a range of a mile. And our guy, the bad guy, Gary Hilton, he's in this platoon. And you know what happens? He cracks up.
Right.
Existential crisis. And what gets worse is that our government does not follow him after they give him a discharge, and he becomes a serial killer.
And he starts to hit the national forests. We talk we talk about the interstate highway killers and the Green River killers and all that sort of stuff. But here's a guy that went to the national forests, and let's talk about that a little bit and prowled them.
Well, what happens is Gary is a guy who by 2007, through circumstance, both professionally in terms of what he's doing. And I should emphasize that this guy he's a whole lot smarter than me, I think. I don't know what my IQ is, but his IQ is in the 120s. And this guy he enlists, they deploy him, this is in the 60s, he gets out, he's schizophrenic, he's already been diagnosed, in the service, they give him Thorazine, they let him go. And you know what happens?
Yeah.
He becomes a serial killer.
Yep.
He kills two people that he's been convicted of, two people he's been charged with killing. God knows how many others he might have been involved in killing. And the United States government does not, and they don't like the fact that I'm talking about this. And they wind up not taking any responsibility. And he preferred national forests because he was an outdoorsman.
Yeah.
And what he would do is he would go into the national forest in the United States. He'd have his dog with him. And he would get friendly with somebody. And when he got friendly with them, he'd kidnap them, keep them as hostage. He would try to access their ATM accounts. And when he did, he would then kill them. Nice guy.
Yeah. And let's talk about his Hollywood. He was a movie maker, too.
Well, I think this is... I haven't studied Canadian history, okay, as much as I should. The only... the one thing I know the most about Canadian history is that in the United States, we were stupid enough to try to come up and conquer you guys in 1776 with Ethan Allen, and that was a pretty stupid thing because it didn't work.
Right.
Okay. But Gary Hilton is the only serial killer in history in both the United States, Canada, and all over who created the plot for a direct-to-video movie called Deadly Run in 1995 about a serial killer. This is what's so weird, Dana. And he then acts it out or plays it out any way you want to phrase it in the millennium. So he creates the plot for the serial killer preying on women, and then he does it in the millennium in real life. He's the only guy in history who's ever done anything like that. This is weird, It's really weird. I mean, it's like when I found this out, I went, "What do I do with this?" It's like, huh? But this is what this guy did, and it's because of the fact that he was so intelligent. He knew how to pitch a story idea to Hollyweird, and he got it made. And so if the people who are listening to us tonight wish to go on, whatever online service you have and download Deadly Run, you're going to see a movie created by a serial killer in 1994, released in 95, and then in 2007 he acts it out by killing at least two people, and there are two more he's about to be tried for in the sovereign state of North Carolina, Dana.
Fred Rosen's here. His new book, Trails of Death, available at barnesandnoble.com, amazon.com. Go to fredrosen.com. Nice new website, Fred.
Thank you, Dana. Hey, listen, I just want to make sure about one thing, because, you and I haven't spoken for a while.
Yep.
And just to let everybody know that I've been on your show before a number of times. You're in the province of Saskatchewan.
You bet.
You are a police officer, and I just want to make sure you're safe.
I am safe, sir.
Thank you. Because I do worry about you. And I just say to myself, man, I don't want to read some story about some bad guy goes into some mall in Saskatchewan. I'm assuming you have malls in Saskatchewan.
Yeah, I think there's one, yeah.
It's about one or two, right?
Yeah, that's
hey,
right.
What's the weather tonight? What's the weather?
You know what? I was just, I don't know if you know Wendy Murphy or not. She's in New England and just had Wendy Murphy on, and she was talking about all the snow. And you're getting snow down there too, so you're kind of getting our weather. And right now it's not too bad outside here.
You know what? I think that the United States has paid for George Bush's presidency twice. I'm glad I can make you laugh. I live in upstate New York, and I have to tell you that we got hit by a hurricane, whatever the hell they called it, on August 25th. And Dana, I have never, ever seen anything like this.
Yeah.
I saw power lines down. It was like a techno thriller.
Right.
with the lines down and all the crews. And my whole county was declared a disaster area.
Wow, it's something else.
And I might add that people were hurt, a few people died.
Yeah.
And we didn't see hide nor hair of the president of the United States.
Nope.
Okay. And I voted for him last time, just to let you know. Hey. And I'm being very, very frank here. And, would have been nice if he'd shown up and said, hey, how you guys doing? But he didn't do that. He was too busy going to a benefit in Beverly Hills or something,
I got to ask you, Fred. Fred Rosen is here, before I let you go. What do you think? Are we going to see pizza ovens in the White House?
Pizza ovens in the... You know what? I hope we don't, and I'll tell you why.
Right.
Because I don't, you know, the way that our governments are going, I don't think they can cook pizza correctly.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, think about it. You know, I don't think they can cook pizza correctly.
Yeah.
So I just hope we don't. Who knows what's going to happen, you know, but it's very, very, I'll tell you this, it is interesting down here. You know, we're all looking at this election coming up, and I can just say one thing, which is we all want a choice, but none of us feel like we're getting a choice.
No.
Regardless of who you're for, we don't feel like we're getting a choice. And that's the part that I believe that, you know, most of us are having problems with. And by the way, I'm not supposed to get political. My publisher said I shouldn't get political, but
no.
What the heck, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. The book is Trails of Death, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com.
Amazon.com. Mm-hmm.
Go to the mall and go to FredRosen.com. You'll learn more about Fred. Thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure.
Dana, do me a favor.
Sure.
Please stay safe.
I will.
All right.
I appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's author Fred Rosen, and he's always a big kick to have on the show. That's it. I hope you enjoyed it. For those of you on Access Communications, thanks for watching. For those of you on Scared Monkeys Radio, you can pick up the show live or podcasts or daily commentaries. And if you're interested, go over to Twitter and sign up to our Twitter page at Dana Pretzer. Thank you. Good night. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.